We have a number of points we want to cover this evening. Make sure we don't forget any of them. I all got them carefully noted here. Proper scholastic manner. First of all, we want to clarify certain basic problems in connection with mysticism as they relate to our personal conduct. So we have to come now to an extension of our concept of definition. In action, in the conduct of life, mysticism represents a basic and entirely natural instinct toward action. In other words, we have people who we variously judge. We say of one individual, he is naturally critical. We say of another, he is naturally suspicious. We may say of a third, he is naturally self-centered. But when we speak of a mystic, we merely say he is naturally a mystic. Now, it is just this kind of basicness that our problem involves. The individual who is naturally critical is not aware that he has cultivated criticism, but he has, whether he knows it or not. He has gradually permitted a certain tendency of his character to become more and more exaggerated. And perhaps as a result of early environment, he has inevitably dropped into an attitude. An attitude which will gravitate against him throughout life. In the same way of thinking, it is not right to assume that mysticism is something acquired, something that represents a sect, or a creed, or a belief which can be adopted by the mind at will or pleasure. Mysticism is a natural condition. And the only reason why we do not all express it or do not all live in its rather simple and gentle structure is that we have permitted other characteristics to become exaggerated so that our mystical potential is ignored or neglected. Man being a total being in himself, having within his own nature all potential, out of universal potential, cannot be deficient essentially in anything necessary for his completeness or his security. Therefore, his insecurity and his incompleteness arise not from natural privation within himself, but from his own attitudes and decisions, and by the virtue or vice of having cultivated certain propensities and having neglected others, perhaps equally important or of greater importance. Thus we now think of our mysticism merely as the individual being himself, allowing those values and qualities which are part of his being to appear in their own proper and normal way. We know that mysticism must have a certain normalcy, otherwise it could not result in normalcy. The individual cannot attain any security by departing from realities. But it is the mystic and those of similar interests or parallel courses of pursuit that attain security, whereas those with other attitudes, less constructive, less total, less unified, do not attain security. Thus we must assume that those qualities which bring into man's life the greatest fullness for himself, these qualities bear the basic authority of nature. For nature is continuously attempting to reveal to us those courses of procedure most likely to be constantly and universally beneficial. Now, as most persons, if they have this mystical equation within themselves, are unable to draw upon it for their immediate needs in many occasions and circumstances, wonder how this mystical value can be released or developed to become a present help in time of emergency. It is obvious that criticism, from a tendency, develops into a powerful dominant in life. Mysticism, from a tendency, may also develop into a powerful dominant. But just as surely as criticism grows by exercise, so mysticism grows by exercise. And as certainly as criticism is strengthened by beholding around itself things which appear to deserve criticism, so mysticism grows and strengthens by observing around itself those things in which the mystical attributes are dominant or obvious. Thus, according to our sight, our vision, our constant awareness of things, we find support either for our strength or our weakness. In nature, as we all know, nearly every position that man can occupy, intellectually or emotionally, may be regarded as justifiable by argument. But only certain attitudes or situations are justifiable by consequence. And one of our first important lessons is, therefore, to recognize that the mystical equation is sustained, justified, supported by the most powerful of all evidence, the evidence of consequence. Against this evidence, once we begin to recognize it, intellectual and emotional debate are fruitless. The individual, in the presence of a fact, must accept this fact to the degree that he is capable of apprehending the fact. It is only when he is unable to perceive that which is true that he can deny it. It is only when his own reason, judgment, and attitude forbid him the acceptance of truth that he can reject it. In this concept of mysticism, therefore, the mystical attitude or the mystical release in life must arise from certain natural and inevitable processes within the temperament itself. These processes are not essentially intellectual. They are processes of experience. We assume always that experience is the one undeniable authority, that out of experience we must come finally to certain conclusions, these conclusions being inherent in the experience, and the experience itself being an evidence or manifestation of life in action. All experience reveals the nature of good and evil. All experience points out the strength and weakness of conduct or action on any level, on any particular subject that may be under immediate consideration. Thus, mysticism being natural, it is essentially something to be rescued rather than to be cultivated. It is something which, being present like a seed in the earth, must be given the kind of care necessary to cause that seed to germinate and grow. Mysticism is not something we must create, something we must import, something that we must receive as a benediction from others. It is a seed within our own consciousness. It is a part of our own internal life. But it is only through a certain dedication or devotion to that seed and to the proper laws governing its development and unfoldment that we can have the full benefit of the maturity and growth and fruitfulness of this seed. Therefore, we find that all things in life which are meaningful involve some effort or responsibility. That which requires no effort is not rewarding. That which is not founded in some degree of human dedication is seldom worthwhile, useful, or permanently beneficial. Thus, if we are anxious to release our own native mysticism, to experience it as a normal growth of ourselves, and therefore something which we need not defend, which need not be creedalized or sectarianized, but may be constantly available to us as a stream of living water rising from interior fountains of our natures. In order to know this experience and to know it with certainty, we must make certain adjustments. Adjustments perhaps with the historical or traditional phase of mysticism, which alone provides us immediately with the keys to things that we must do. But it should be understood that all disciplines or theories or concepts about mysticism are merely means of bringing to our attention that which becomes valid only by our own experience. We cannot be mystics by conversion unless we wish to assume that we are converting ourselves when we so live that we reveal to ourselves the facts of ourselves. This constitutes the only true means of becoming certainly and faithfully aware of those principles that are necessary for our living. So in our practical application, we begin with the recognition that the end of our endeavor is that we shall know by experience, that we shall have things happen to us that are so completely undeniable that there can be no rebellion against them, no resistance to them, and no denying that they represent a diviner law working in the natural world. This also, we should bear in mind that mysticism per se requires no defense. It is not something that is sustained by argument or protected jealously by some secretiveness of our own. That which can be assailed must be assailed. That which is true cannot be assailed. Therefore, it needs neither defender, nor can it be injured by accuser. It remains in its own nature and substance as it is, and men approach it or retire from it according to their natures, but its own nature is unchangeable. This is a certain security, for it gives us confidence that at the root of life there are values which are eternal, true, and ever-present. Nature is so constructed that the mystical equation is forever available to us, not by some miraculous or extraordinary experience, for as Lord Bacon says, it is not necessary for deity to convince us through miracles, inasmuch as the commonest of his works are sufficiently miraculous in themselves. This thought is very noble and proper to our consideration. So we're now going to take some of the aspects of practical mysticism and look into them for a moment. We have somewhat defined our position for this evening. Therefore, we will say that the search for mysticism is a search involving the use of the power of insight. Now, insight is direct cognition. Insight means not only seeing within, but it means a kind of apperceiving which is rooted completely in direct cognition of value. Insight is through sight. It is the sight of a thing which is deceived not by its appearances, nor is it rationally deceived by its defenses, or emotionally deceived by its pleadings and protestations. Insight is that which is not deceived, because it is concerned not with the appearances of things directly, but with their substances and essences. The cultivation of insight, then, suggests the need for a clairvoyant power of some nature, or the extension of our sensory perceptions into the ability to perceive into internals. Actually, however, insight, as termed in mysticism, does not immediately require any extrasensory perception whatsoever. Insight is for man complete perceiving. It is a perceiving in which cognition is true, right, honorable, and sufficient, because it is not adulterated by prejudice or opinion. because it is not diluted by tradition, nor is it overwhelmed by what we commonly refer to as human authority. Insight, then, is free sight. It is sight free to see. Now, our way of life bestows certain physical freedoms upon us. To attain these freedoms, our ancestors fought gallantly, defending with their lives the right for physical freedom. We today are searching for other kinds of freedoms, not only the four freedoms, but perhaps one of the most important, and that is the freedom to think straight, the freedom of insight, the freedom to perceive the thing as it is. And against this great desired and reasonable and purposeful freedom, we have arrayed not only the prejudices of others, but the involved, complicated mechanism of self-deceit. Consequently, insight must achieve a gradual victory over self-deceit. Now, self-deceit is often very subtle, difficult to cope with, inasmuch as it represents angles and faculties and phases and aspects of temperament which we have gradually come to regard as essential parts of our own natures. One of the difficulties, then, is that wherever we are asked to change an attitude, we assume that we are asked to change ourselves. This is not essentially true, for in most instances, the attitude does not represent the self. The attitude is something that already has enslaved the self, thrown it into bondage, imprisoned it, and prevented its free impression and expression. We must therefore assume that the self, by its own nature, desires honor, desires to know, and desires to perceive the fact of things. But against this natural desire is false conditioning, which inevitably causes us to become victimized by negations and distortions of our own mental and emotional nature. Therefore, insight is nothing but honest vision of thing as it is. Now, to attain honest vision, the individual must, for the most part, reduce a certain kind of equation within himself. Honesty is not something that can be cultivated. You cannot say, day by day, in every way, I will be more and more honest. That might be an evident couism, but it is not sustainable in action. We cannot cause honesty to increase, because honesty is not something that has of itself the nature of increase. Honesty is something that is. And because it is, and because it is universal in its own nature, because it is everywhere, not more distant nor nearer, but all permeating and all penetrating, and because honesty of itself is unassailable, therefore can never be destroyed, never be corrupted, never be prevented from being itself. Our situation is not to ride valiantly like some St. George to the salvation of honesty. Our real problem is to eliminate the dishonesty in ourselves. We cannot make anything more honest, but we can cause all things to be less dishonest. This is a very subtle negation, but it is one of the greatest importance. It is present everywhere in which we have the egoism of the human mind, assuming that it can add or subtract in relation to the substance of things. This it cannot do. It can either accept more or less of this substance. And what we would term the increase of honesty is merely the acceptance of it in our own nature to larger and larger degree. It has nothing to do with an actual increase in the circumstance or fact of honesty itself. Man may be dishonest all his life, and yet live with an intrinsic honesty within himself. He may live dishonestly in a world filled with honesty and be untouched by it. It is his own relationship to himself that determines, therefore, his ability to release, reveal, or express certain eternally present values. Insight, therefore, is merely the recognition that honesty is that which remains when dishonesty ceases. The individual who affirms that if he does not do wrong, he will do nothing, is not substantially correct. To cease doing wrong does not mean the end of action. It simply means the end of wrong action, or of the wrong use of action. The individual whose mind and emotions are no longer victims of error will then find an automatic release of virtue or correctness through his nature. We are blocked by our own limitations and by our own misinterpretations of values. If we get out of our own way, value continues to express itself as was intended, and as must always be the law and nature of value. Insight to us is a gradual conviction that the individual, by internal experience, can become aware, can know through a direct and immediate cognition the fact of universal value. Mysticism is an aspect of this universal value. Mysticism is this value largely in terms of conduct and peculiarly applicable to human beings. The mystic is not a person who ceases all action, but who rather exchanges the grossness of conditioned action for a fuller value sense, in which his action becomes more significant, although quite possibly less violent. We have no proof whatever that violence of action adds anything to its significance. And we have much proof that violence of action exhausts the individual and places him in situations in which it is ever more difficult for him to retain insight, even what degree of it he would otherwise possess. So insight as direct cognition may tell the thoughtful person that there is ever available to him the proper substance of insight, that toward which insight is naturally turned. And this thing toward which it is turned is value, or essence, or substance, or reality. That this reality is available at all times and in any situation and in every situation. And that every condition which arises is one of conditioned value. That is, one in which value is variously frustrated by that which is not valuable, causing innumerable complications and emergencies in the practice of human conduct. Insight, therefore, tells us also that value may be revealed in two ways, either through a direct apperception of itself or an indirect recognition of it as the result of the tragedy of allegiance to that which is not value. The individual may therefore grow directly by clinging to the truth, or he may grow indirectly by exhausting error. Unfortunately, however, in exhausting error, he is apt to exhaust himself and everyone else. Consequently, in the conserving of energy and the preservation of life for his own good and for the good of his associates, it is far better that he shall become, so far as is possible, dedicated to insight, to the effort to perceive and experience value. The commonest form of insight, the most natural form, is that by means of which we become sensitive to motive and sensitive to the underlying elements of a situation. Insight permits us to penetrate appearances, whether these appearances are favorable or unfavorable, in an effort to determine value in contrast to appearance. Man, having in mind which is capable of individual intellection, is capable of conduct contrary to his own instincts. The individual is capable, therefore, of deceit. He is capable of pretending one thing and practicing another. We know this without very much use of insight. We recognize this as one of the common problems of our time, and as a result of this, we become profoundly suspicious of the conduct of those around us. Now, suspicion is by itself a negative value. It is something which, if maintained long enough, will produce detrimental effects upon the mental, emotional, and physical structure of man. Therefore, we must assume that in the natural plan of things, suspicion is not a virtue, that it is not a faculty that is given to man for his preservation. If it was, it would be used in this way without interfering with the basic integrity of the individual. If suspicion were a proper faculty, the individual would grow by the use of it. He would also find himself enjoying better and more continuous security because of this attitude. Such is not the case. And the history of suspicion, as it passes gradually into a clinical condition as mental disease, shows clearly that the only thing that suspicion rewards itself with is more suspicion. And that if this is allowed to pile up indefinitely, it becomes pathological. Thus, suspicion does not solve anything. Yet, says the person who has been gradually indoctrinated with suspicious attitudes by circumstances around him, how can we protect ourselves without being suspicious? How can we make certain that without suspicion we will not be exploited? How can we say that a dozen times we have been subjected to the deceit of others, and that we should approach these others a 13th time with a good hope and a cheerful countenance? This looks as though it is almost more than flesh can bear. And we are inclined to assume that the effort to do so is little short of ridiculous. It is, as long as we approach with the same attitudes and with the same equipment that we approached before, and which attitude and equipment led to our immediate exploitation. Insight is not suspicion. Insight, however, is fact hunting and fact finding. Nearly every individual who is deceived and who thereby becomes inclined to be suspicious is not deceived because of his honesty, but he is deceived primarily because of his lack of insight. He is deceived by his selfishness. One of the most common forms of deceit that we contact is the individual who, for a quick profit, is lured into an unreasonable or unprofitable investment. This lack of insight is obvious. He should have realized that when he engaged in an enterprise in which common sense told him the hazards were far greater than the probabilities of reward, he should have faced this fact honestly, immediately, and factually. He should have realized that he took a long chance because he expected more than reasonable profit. This was not a virtuous action, but a foolish one, arising from his own cupidity. Cupidity is destructive to insight, but leads to conduct which sustains suspicion. And as surely as he is himself exploited, others become suspicious of him if he offers or promises that which he cannot reasonably fulfill. Thus, in the individual lies the factor which, different from insight, leads him to a different kind of estimation of other persons. Criticism, suspicion, these attitudes are not the same as a factual analysis of the problem. A factual analysis depends entirely upon a non-emotional, impersonal recognition of value. The recognition of the abiding location of the fact of the matter. Insight, then, is the quickest, easiest, most natural way to become strong. It protects the person from his own weakness, from his own gullibility, which is a form of weakness. It prevents him from contributing to the delinquency of another. It does not place him in relationships with others by which suspicion can reasonably result. Insight, then, is always a factual look at something. Usually, facts have a certain charm about them. Facts are not, very often, truly bad. It is the failure to find the fact that results in what we call evil. The fact may be ridiculous, ludicrous, amusing. It may be entertaining. It may be everything that you can think of until it falls upon us to our detriment. And for it to do this, it must be misinterpreted and misapplied in our own lives. Insight can therefore begin with a proper evaluation of situations around us and a gradual releasing of our minds from these vast, unsemantic expressions of total acceptance and total discarding of things. Nothing is all this or all that. And the moment prejudice comes in, fact flies out the window. Insight is our quiet ability to penetrate all subterfuge and to perceive those obvious symptoms which never fail to be present. The only way we can be deceived is to close our eyes to obvious facts. And to close our eyes thus results in a penalizing. And when we have been penalized for several times, we are afraid that we will be penalized again. So we wander about waiting for the worst. Whereas the answer lies not in this procedure, but in simply opening our eyes, which have been closed through all the previous episodes. By the simple opening of our awareness, so that we become naturally and normally conscious of the inevitable associate factors, the symptoms which are never separate from any situation in life. Every situation is the result of causes which can be estimated. Every situation leads to effects which can be evaluated. And it is our failure to observe causes and evaluate effects. It is our failure to judge things by their values and their principles. This is the mistake, or the type of mistake, which leads us into most of our unpleasant situations. Insight is not something which you should sit down and say, this afternoon I will turn it on. And while I am turning it on, I will examine a condition which has arisen. Insight should be as natural to us as criticism. Insight should be the ability to see a little further into every stone wall than we have ever seen before. Insight should be an attitude toward observing things. It should be the power of the individual to accept more evidence, consciously and subconsciously, because he has not closed his attention to that evidence, because he has not willfully refused to see it, or has allowed some prejudice or attachment or detachment to stir his mind away from normal perception. Insight is clear sight because the sensory perceptions, normally and properly used, will carry with us, with them, into our consciousness, not only the immediate structure of things, but a certain aura of overtones. These overtones are visible or can be determined by the senses. They can also be estimated after the phenomena has been accepted by the rational faculties. And the individual can instinctively and intuitively gain an ability to perceive value or the absence of it as easily as he now perceives the rising of the sun or watches the traffic ahead of him. In some ways, under certain stressful emotional pressures, we do develop certain overtones. Perhaps one of the most common of these developments today is in the case of the motorist. The motorist, subconsciously, if he's a good driver, and if there were not millions of good drivers, there would be very few of us left alive. The motorist, because he is in a constant condition of emergency, does have a degree of insight in relation to driving very much in excess of his insight on other subjects. He sees, he recognizes, he almost sees behind him. He becomes able to make note of the slightest variation in traffic patterns. He becomes almost intuitively aware of what the driver in front is going to do, because the old age of arm signals is practically extinct. It requires a moderate degree of telepathy to get home. Because he has to have it to survive, man develops it. And it is quite amazing how rapidly his coordination also adjusts itself to an emergency. Without time to consciously think at all, the good driver will nearly always do the one thing that is possible under the situation and likely to reduce a tragedy or a difficulty to the minimum. Drivers have told me that where an accident was obviously only a split second away, that in that split second, it seemed as though eternity never moved. That split second became longer than an hour. And in that split second, a tremendous amount of intellection was possible. And in that split second, the individual was frequently able to actually completely avert the accident, although there seemed to be no time for such judgment. He discovered that he had the faculty of instantaneous analysis and judgment, but he had not used it. This is perhaps a shallow similitude toward insight, but it is in this direction. It is the power of the individual to see more than he realizes, react more intelligently than he consciously knows, and to avert a condition by the total union of his faculties. Such faculties exist, are available to man, but he simply does not use them. And the principal reason why he has trouble with them is because in daily life, his prejudices are stronger than his emergencies, and he never gets that clear flash of direct and complete insight. It is as though he were intoxicated with the psychic toxins of his own wrong thinking, which can be just as detrimental to him as they are in the form of alcoholic intoxication on a highway. His reflexes are reduced on the highway by the alcohol in his blood. In private and civilian life, man's reflexes to insight are reduced by the psychic toxin of his attitudes, and the true insight is therefore not available to him. To try to correct this situation, to practice it a little, to try to see more about things, to observe their values and their relationships, so that instead of merely recording an optical phenomenon, we record with it something of the cause of itself, something of the consequence of itself. One of the Greek philosophers suggested it in this way. Through a certain familiarity, man is aware of the overtones of certain conditions around him. A man looking at a tree in bloom can with his mind see the fruit that is to come upon that tree. He knows that the flowers of the tree, the blossoms, will become fruit in due time. And by a slight extension of his thinking, he can see the growth of this tree from the seedling in which it started. He can restore these thoughts to his mind, or they may almost spring to his mind when he contemplates the tree, especially if he has some interest in the subject. If the payment of his mortgage depends upon the fruit, he will see the fruit before it is there. He will judge it, he will estimate it, he will try to imagine anything that might prevent it from developing, and he will do all that he can to preserve the naturalness of the situation in order that he may survive himself. It is the same with all incidents in life. If these incidents are truly important to us, we will anticipate them, we will observe them and contemplate them. Not in a long and arduous intellectual process, but intuitively, instinctively, by insight. We will search not for the incident, but for the value. And in so doing, we will gradually enlarge these auric overtones. For the values of things lie in their overtones, rather than in the objects themselves. And our search for mysticism is always our search for value. Now, the next point is important to us also. Mysticism emphasizes continuously the presence of what we might term a spiritual factor, a spiritual idealistic equation, in every situation that is contemplated. Mysticism, therefore, must move from the sincere conviction that in every problem that we know, there is a God in it somewhere. Mysticism particularly emphasizes the discovery of the God equation. And this God equation represents the essential good, the spiritual fact in things. This is, however, not so valuable to us unless this emphasis has some practical meaning for us. It was true that the old Indian, the American Indian, saw God in fire and heard him in the winds. That is true. But we have to find our utility, our practical application of this principle. To affirm that there is a God in things is to affirm that there is a good in things, and also to affirm that all things have concealed within them somewhere a spiritual equation, which means an equation of value. This equation of value usually impacts itself upon our experience as the equation of lesson, of meaning, of that which it can help us to know, or to understand, or to attain, or to achieve, concerning which we were previously ignorant in some essential part or degree. Consequently, the spiritual essence of value for us in everything that occurs is instruction. The individual who is living to learn
will have a far more significant and successful life than the individual who is merely living to gain. Gain is precarious in these times, and for each gain there must be a loss. Consequently, gain brings little, if any, actual security. On the other hand, the individual who lives for lessons, or at least very largely accepts lessons as an essential value in life, can hardly have a life that is a failure. He can hardly resist the recognition of the magnificence of existence if he is willing to accept life as a way of learning. This does not mean that learning must be painful. We have come so completely and entirely to the conclusion that learning is a miserable and uncomfortable procedure that it is hard for us to conceive that learning can be beautiful, that learning can be good, and that learning can be important. If, therefore, in connection with our basic study, we take the attitude that learning is the spiritual equation in the things that we do, then we find a divine nature or insight in everything and about everything that is possible for us to understand and to know. If then, on this basis of thinking, we attempt to grasp the experience value of things, we do not have the difficulties in accepting life that would otherwise be present. If we are able to accept learning as the spiritual integrity which justifies life, if we are more interested in being happy because we have learned than being happy because we have been successful, we will have a great possibility of a rich and full life. If, however, our happiness must result only from situations that meet our personal approval, we are going to have, usually, a troublesome time. Thus, mysticism has as one of its basic concepts the discovery of the spiritual equation, the recognition that whatever happens encloses within itself a vital meaning, that the discovery of this vital meaning always justifies any trouble, misfortune or pain necessary to attain that meaning, that there is no failure in life except the failure to attain meaning. A failure to attain meaning, fortunately, is rare, because nature, by its own natural energies, persists in revealing meaning until it is presented so fully, completely, and inevitably that we must ultimately turn toward it and accept it. Spiritual insight, or the spiritual equation, helps the mystic, therefore, to realize continuously that this is a divine world, and that these things which happen to us and to others, which do not appear to be divine, have within them a divine meaning, and that this meaning has as its end, goal, and ultimate man's mystical experience of God as good. That out of all these things, the person can achieve the victory of self over all circumstances that can arise, and that this victory in itself is made possible by man realizing that the word self, spelled with a capital S, is not only a symbol of our personal natures, but of the God self in us, by which all things are possible, including that degree of insight which is man's power to perceive that God in the things that have burdened him, afflicted him, frightened him. This discovery is possible, and it is the mystic who attempting sincerely and honorably to find this equation, to know it, to recognize it, and to accept it into himself, relaxing with it or to it, and remembering, as all mystics must remember, that it is not man of himself that accomplishes these things, but as Jesus said, it is the Father in I that doeth the works. And it is part of the essential concept of mysticism to discover the spiritual equation, which simply means the equation in which it is the Father in us that doeth the works. And that this spiritual value gives us the power, gives us the eternal and everlasting right to perceive the truth, to exercise our own natures toward the attainment of a reality which is possible because we are of the substance of reality. Were we not of this substance, we could not know it. But because we are of this substance, we can attain it through dedication, through relaxation away from error, from recovering from all self-pity and self-censure, and simply, quietly, affirming that which mysticism has forever affirmed, namely, the spiritual equation, which means the absolute justice in the substance of things. And that this justice has as its principal end that each human being, in the course of its natural growth and unfoldment, shall become aware of this justice, shall ultimately rejoice in this justice, and shall perceive in this justice the first and perfect testimony of the presence of God in all things. This concept, then, is the next point in our study of the mystical equation. The next factor that I want to speak of is mysticism as a way of binding what we know to what we do. This is a very important equation. Intellection can permit us to contemplate the most glorious and wonderful vistas of reality. Mysticism, however, is not a philosophy per se, nor a religion. Mysticism is a kind of action. Mysticism is therefore an active force, acting with instead of contrary to the large patterns of universal action. That which moves with life may not appear to move, because it moves with the total picture of things. But this is the most important and graceful motion of all, for it is motion in Tao, as the Chinese call it, or motion in infinite motion. And there is a great difference in the life of man between motion and commotion. Motion is a movement with life. Commotion is a shadow boxing with errors. Motion is therefore a flowing of life into its own natural and proper purposes and applications. Our mystical situation, then, shows that man has a kind of knowledge. Now, knowledge is a natural acquirement of man. Knowledge is the negative pole of this intuitive kind of insight. Knowledge is a learning about things, about conditions, involving arts and sciences and crafts and trades. Knowledge, however, is not as sterile as it seems to be, because knowledge to the mystic becomes in every instance another example of the presence of the divine in action. Therefore, the great mathematician says, God geometrizes. He has found God in mathematics as Baron Emanuel Swedenborg found him. The great physicist finds God in atoms. The great biologist finds God in tissue. The astronomer finds God in space. Everywhere, knowledge as we know it becomes a living witness and testimony to the presence of divine power. But the transformation of knowledge, so that man moves from this realization, if all knowledge reveals God, then the application of knowledge reveals worship. And to the mystic, worship may be therefore practiced in any field of learning, or in any department of living, or in any pursuit of man, so long as this pursuit is ennobled and enlightened by man's personal acceptance that this form of learning, or this type of work or craft, is a service to God and nature. If man is capable of recognizing the dignity of action, he realizes that all action is meditation. All work is prayer. And as the mystic Essenes of the Holy Land said 2,000 years ago, the perfect water of baptism is the sweat of human toil. These mystics worshipped through work. And one of the points of mysticism that is tremendously significant is the idea of bringing the element of worship into work. That worship is not apart from every other purpose of man, nor is worship a burdensome and heavy theological procedure. The Greeks, who were among the great theologians of all time, worshiped with laughter. Man worships through the joyous recognition of the presence of the divine power in all of his labors and his pursuits. The great artist sees in God the supreme artist. The great architect sees in deity the supreme artificer of all things. Therefore, the architect builds for the glory of God.